Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith.
All signs are that we may be facing a kind of global economic collapse because of peak oil.
The amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting out into the atmosphere is rising to a point now where most scientists would agree that we may be at a sort of tipping point.
Now we're seeing an order of extinctions now that ranks with the great catastrophes on the planet.
It is possible to exceed carrying capacity, but only temporarily.
We got to the peak, and there's trouble all around us. What should we do?
Dominion over the earth in Genesis didn't mean to leave this pillaged and smoking.
200 species a day. This is calamitous.
Is it just all going to end, and is that going to be the solution?
Everything that we receive, everything we see, hear, smell, taste, feel, originates in or is mediated by humans and machines.
So if you look at the people who have been assimilated into empire, and if you look at the imperialists themselves, you find an incredible dissociation from reality.
Radio EcoShock.
We can't survive apart from the Earth. We're killing it.
We are all dreaming, and the alarm clock rings. It's too hot. There is a smell of smoke in the air. The car is still parked outside. The television works, but there's nothing worth watching. What should I buy? How can I feed this gnawing need to live some way better? What a way to go. That's the title of a new film written and directed and edited by Tim Bennett and produced by Sally Erickson. You just heard one of the trailers. In the film, we follow the angst of Tim Bennett, who wants, just like all of us, to live the American dream. A family, a job, a tropical vacation now and then. But reality is cracking on the sides. There seem to be a series of monsters waiting at the door. Climate change, peak oil, toxic blood in our babies, and the wars at the end of empire. How are we supposed to handle all that? Is there a way out? Let's go to the interview with Tim Bennett and Sally Erickson from their base in North Carolina. There is a new film out there you need to see. It's called What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire. As the website puts it, a middle-class white guy comes to grips with peak oil, climate change, mass extinction, population overshoot, and the demise of the American lifestyle. The interviews for the film read like a who's who of alternative thinking, from Daniel Quinn to Jerry Mander, Richard Heinberg, and a lot more. The film What a Way to Go was written, directed, and edited by Tim Bennett and produced by Sally Erickson. We have them with us today. Hi there.
Hey, Alex.
Hi.
All right, well, there's a growing mix of fears, and we could add financial collapse to that as well these days, and it seems to be swirling around. You two were ahead of the curve making this film. What sort of reactions are you getting?
A mix of reactions. Largely, people are quite grateful that we are speaking clearly and connecting a lot of dots, putting together a wider view of the situation so that it's not a matter of just looking at isolated, troublesome issues, but beginning to go more deeply into the roots of the problem. So I think people are feeling kind of a new clarity from taking that kind of view.
One of our favorite reactions is when somebody comes to us afterwards and says, "I thought I was crazy," or "I thought I was all alone." And one of our primary reasons for making this was to connect with people and tell them, you're neither crazy nor alone. There's a bunch of us out here looking at what's going on.
Well, there's something about this society that does seem to isolate us. I don't know if... Do you know the book Bowling Alone? Have you heard of that one?
No, haven't.
Well, just a great book to get a hold of, because it talks about how people have stopped joining various clubs and societies, and they're more or less isolated in front of their television sets. And so it seems like a film like this needs to draw people out of that cocoon and join them together. Do you see that happening?
Well, when we were on tour, we've been on tour twice in the last few months, once to the northeast of the United States and once to the west, including British Columbia. And when we go on tour with the movie, we pull together people afterwards who are interested into a dialogue circle. And so in that way, we're certainly trying to pull people together. I also remember on another interview as an introduction, Janaea Donaldson on Peak Moments suggested that people see the movie with a trusted friend so that they could go and connect and talk deeply about it afterwards.
It's one of the reasons that we don't look at this stuff. It's one of the reasons we so often just lapse into denial. We're atomized. We're so often by ourselves with no community and no support system. So to look at something, you know, huge and scary and overwhelming by yourself, that doesn't work, and most people won't do it. So we really encourage, you know, I mean, one of the things that we're about is trying to get people to realize that they can look at this together and form communities around talking about this. And it's one of the things we've left in our wake is a few communities that are coming together and talking about this more fully now.
Well, the film does reach out to a kind of cross-cultural crowd. I mean, once upon a time, peak oil people didn't talk about climate change, and, well, nobody wants to talk about overpopulation, much less the disappearing species. Do you see a convergence of these interests growing now?
Well, I do. I think that there are a lot more people connecting the dots. If you're at all active on any of the peak oil websites, or the climate change websites, everybody's beginning to see that there are common roots to all of these problems, namely that the culture of civilization found fossil fuels and exploded in every direction, and that explosion is causing huge damage. And I think slowly but surely people are beginning to see that these aren't isolated individual problems, but a deeper cultural problem.
Well, what did you start out with? I mean, how did this film come about?
I'd been feeling kind of an angst or a discomfort, or sometimes I described it as kind of an itchiness about the last 10 years. I've been a psychotherapist, and I knew that people were coming into my office and we were working on individual problems, but I could see more and more how they were affected by the culture. And I've always been a bit out of the mainstream since I was a young adult, and so it helped me see that the culture was at the bottom of a lot of people's difficulty. But I didn't know what to do about it until I picked up Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about 4.5 years ago. And he was the first one that really did connect all of the dots for me. And then I met Tim, and Tim was beginning to connect the dots as well.
Yeah, it's like you can't grow up in this culture and not have some vague sense that things are terribly off. I mean, even as a kid, the movies, the music, the stories, the apocalyptic science fiction, the dystopian futures, all through that, I was hearing messages that told me things can't go on the way they are. And I even remember studying Malthus in my biology class back in the 70s and kind of, you know, that has always stuck with me, like, oh, that's going to be a problem. So it's the notion that we're sort of living in a very strange and unprecedented time has always been with me. And the germ of the idea for the documentary has been with me for a long time. And at the point where I finished a 2-year film program, I met Sally. She handed me Tom Hartman's book, and we just dove right into it full time at that point.
Well, it's pretty hard for people to react to one problem, much less 4 or 5 of them coming. How are we going to integrate this spread of threats into our own lives? How can we even come to grips with it?
What a great question. I think I'm hoping we'll come to grips with it rather rapidly. Tim and I were laughing about this when we were on tour a little bit, because while in the movie he talks about how it's really been over the last 15 to 20 years that he's been coming to grips with it since the early 80s, we don't really have time anymore to take that kind of leisurely attitude toward these things, because they're pressing down on us rather rapidly. For me, it's been getting the information and then having Tim and a couple of other people who were willing to stay right on top of it and feel our way through it to come to grips with the fact that my life can't and shouldn't continue to be dependent and on high energy use and on destroying the very fabric of life support systems on the planet. That it's not only wrong and immoral, it's unsatisfying, and it just flat out isn't going to work. We're destroying our life support systems. We've got to stop. And it takes time to let all of that really sink in. But I also think that once people look at that, they actually, as Tim and I have found, start to feel a new energy, because they're not wasting a lot of their energy on distraction and denial and basically unfulfilling activity, and instead they're beginning to connect more deeply with the natural world, which is intrinsically nourishing and satisfying, and they're starting to make rapid and interesting and compelling changes in their life. And while it's scary and challenging, it's also pretty exciting.
One of the things that we heard more than anything else in our interviews was when people would say, it's going to take a catastrophe. And by that, I took that to mean that it's going to take pain so great and right in our own backyard, such that we can't escape it or deny it. So coming to grips with it, to me, means allowing the catastrophe. Now, the catastrophe is going on in the planet already.
But sure, and in California or in many places where you look.
Right. But we defend against it. We don't allow it into our bodies. We don't allow ourselves to feel it. So when you allow yourself to feel the catastrophe that's already going on, then it works on you and it changes you. And you have to process your way through it. And that's why community is so important, because we need a safe place to do that emotional processing work. But once you do that, as Sally says, you do come on the other side, a changed and very different person. So, you know, we can come to grips with the catastrophe now, when we're just kind of, for the most part, at least here in the United States, we're looking out toward a catastrophe that's coming. That's not true everywhere in the planet. In many places around the planet, the catastrophe has been around a long time. But if we can allow ourselves to look at it now and feel our way through it now, we don't have to wait until it whacks us upside the head. We can be prepared for it ahead of time. We can see it coming.
I think that's really profound. I think that we do have to adjust. And so you're saying this really isn't an end-of-the-world film, but a kind of transitional film looking for a better way out. Am I hearing you rightly?
Well, partly you're hearing us right. I mean, when you come to grips with the fact that we're losing 200 species a day, and we're probably close to or beyond the peak of oil extraction, which means our lifestyles can't continue to be high energy, When you look at the fact that we are rapidly approaching, if we haven't already gone over the edge of any number of climate change tipping points, it's the end of the world as we've known it or as we've imagined it's going to be in the future. At the same time, there are some wonderful things afoot. People since the 70s have been looking at some of this stuff, and an example of that would be the global spread of permaculture, which is a different way of looking at how to get what we need to sustain ourselves in terms of food without disrupting everything around us that totalitarian agriculture does. And so it's the beginning of some new ways of being on the planet. I'd say it's the end of the world as we've known it, and it's the beginning of something that could actually be quite satisfying if people will embrace it.
Well, as filmmakers, have you felt at all pressured by people who are in denial, is it unpatriotic to say the demise of the American lifestyle? Are you feeling that kind of kickback as well?
Only rarely, a little bit, but go ahead, Jim.
You know, the demise of the American lifestyle may be the good news. I don't think most people are really very happy with the American lifestyle, even though we may pretend to be.
Well, just going to the malls and spending because you feel a little blue and then throwing it out a couple of months later, that's not really an inner dialogue that a lot of us are going to be happy with, it seems to me. Well, now, a film like this, is it ever finished? I'll bet you get the feedback and the interview frenzy has stimulated a lot of new directions for you. Are you working on another project?
We're working on getting our own life in order at this point. We kind of set everything aside for the last 3.5 or 4 years. And we see that it's extremely important, partly to lead by example. And so we're in the process of figuring out how we're going to not only lighten our footprint, but explore how to become healing agents. The human species, at least the human species as it's been conditioned and enculturated by empire, has wreaked horrible damage, and we need to learn to live in ways that heal and help regenerate the systems that we've been destructive of. Whether another film project will come out of that, I don't know. First, we got to get our own house in order.
We have talked about doing some long form dialogues in relation to the film, or you know, a 3-day or even a week long. We've also talked about turning it into a curriculum at some point and teaching. There's possibilities for turning it into some sort of a book project or a research project for people. So,
well, you know, I'm glad to hear you use the word healing, because part of the reason I called my project Eco Shock is it's almost like the medical term of shock when people are in an accident and they're stunned and they don't really know which way is up for a little while. And I think as people look at the climate situation and peak oil and the things we've been talking about today, it can be a little damaging to our inner lives, and we have to struggle to get back out of it and build new connections, just the way you've been talking about. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure that it's damaging to our inner life as much as a huge disruption to kind of our denial and defense systems. And that certainly is shocking for a lot of people. But I think that we've been so disconnected from our rootedness with each other and with the natural world that actually, after the initial shock, the healing is, the opportunity for healing is profound, and that people actually who go through this process end up kind of becoming much quieter, more thoughtful, and more more grounded and centered people.
So really it's a way of connecting.
Precisely, when we've been all disconnected and out of touch. You know, people's lives are often incredibly pressured, trying to keep up with a huge house and a huge mortgage and huge car payments and, you know, some kind of imagined status as, you know, the champions of this lifestyle. It's exhausting, and it's not really fulfilling. It's addictive, but not tremendously rewarding in the end.
Could you folks tell us, how can we get this film? How can we watch it?
Well, people can get in touch with us via our website, which is whatawaytogomovie.com. And the documentary is available for sale over the website at this point. There are also community screenings, and there's a page on our website that lists community screenings, and more of those are starting to pop up. So that's another way.
Tim, I'd like to give you a chance here. You know, an interviewer can't be psychic and know all the things that you might like to pass on to our listeners. So I'm just going to hand you an open mic here, and what would you like to tell us?
We're moving into a time of great and astounding change, and we're going to be seeing some very new things. And while that can be unsettling, disturbing, painful, there will be much loss and much to grieve as we move through this. Ultimately, I think this is good news, because it's good news for the planet. It's good news for the entire community of life. One of the people we interviewed was a young man named Rand Prier, and he said that, you know, we can look at this as the collapse of some present current civilization, or we can say, you know, the collapse happened 5, 10, 15,000 years ago, when this culture collapsed into domination and destruction and hierarchy, and now we actually have the opportunity to rise back out of that, to rise out of that paradigm and into some new paradigm of relationship and some new way of looking at the community of life on this planet. So, yes, there will be much change, but we also have a real opportunity to grow up as a culture. And I think that's a really good thing to keep in mind.
Oh, Tim, well, thanks for passing that along. I'm probably going to listen to that again. There's a lot there that you just said. And how about you, Sally? Is there something you'd like to add?
I think that I would like to add that there are lots of young people that are quite discouraged, but we've recently come across a small handful of young people who have realized that maybe there is an amazing opportunity, and that they get to not just clean up the mess, but in fact step into a really exciting new time, and where creativity and connection will abound. And so I hope that young people will, those that have felt discouraged and alienated, will keep their ears and eyes open and open up to the possibility that there are some really wonderful peers for them to find and meet and join together with, and that they don't have to be stuck in this culture, that that there are great forces afoot besides those that we see, and wonderful spiritual magical things are also possible.
Well, having met you two today, Sally Erickson and Tim Bennett, I know people would be interested in the film What a Way to Go at whatawaytogomovie.com. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Alex. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
When you start the film, there is a warning. It is dense material, and indeed it is. Both the images and the quotes have been wound so tightly together that I found the whole movie was more like a multimedia workbook combined with therapy session. Investigating the breakup of the most complex civilization of all time always brings up too much. We all experience it, the overload. This film packs it in, and yet it does keep it in focus. I know I have to go back and watch it again, hitting the stop and rewind to grab things, to let things sink in. Forget light entertainment. This is a serious film for troubled people in a serious time. You can order the film What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire from the website at whatawaytogomovie.com. Or better yet, contact Tim and Sally at the site and arrange a screening in your community. Wake a few other people up while you're at it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Don't forget you can find several megabytes of free radio programs on every aspect of the environmental crisis at our website, ecoshock.org. Let's finish off this segment with a song from American singer Celia. Just Celia, spelled C-E-L-I-A. This singer-songwriter was inspired to write the piece Lovingly Let It Go after watching the film What a Way to Go. But I'm going to play another tune from her fifth and newest album, Red, Alabaster, and Blue. This is We'll Always Sing. And you can hear a lot more from her website at myspace.com/Celia Online.
Today has been an eerie day, an empty day for two. And though it's ending in confusion, feel much closer to you. I do not know your name, I don't know where you're from, but I've seen this city take its toll. But it's no matter what they take from me, they'll not infect my soul. I'll always sing.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Whether it's nuclear weapons, depleted uranium, or just old-fashioned risky reactor fuel with no place to go, Canada is the world's number one supplier of deadly uranium to the world. In fact, one company, a former government-supported corporation called Cameco, is the world's biggest uranium producer. Cameco found the richest uranium deposit ever, kind of a Saudi Arabia of the North, underneath a lake in northern Saskatchewan province. Environmentalists and native groups warned about the dangers of tunneling under a lake to dig up highly radioactive material. But the leftist government of Saskatchewan, with plenty of federal cheerleading and money, approved the project. On October 23, 2006, the whole tunnel filled with water. Expensive giant protective doors failed to work. The multi-billion dollar project is in recovery mode and not expected to open before 2011 or maybe even 2014. It is one big mess. We'll hear more about all that from our next interview guest, Jim Harding. As uranium jumped from $7 a pound around the year 2000 to over $70 now, small exploration companies are trying to drill into radioactive deposits all across Canada. The Kettle River Valley and the Okanagan area is threatened by exploration for a uranium mine. In 2006, a coalition of environmental, community, and Aboriginal groups formed Uranium Free BC Coalition to stop it. That's at uraniumfreebc.org. The Aboriginal Inuit government in Labrador is deciding whether to accept or ban new uranium mining there near the coastal community of Postville. They fear contamination. In Ontario, hunger striker Donna Dillman heads into the second month of her hunger strike to protest a proposed uranium mine north of Charbot Lake in eastern Ontario. Now in a wheelchair, this grandmother has moved her protest to the chilly steps of the Ontario Legislature in Toronto.
Being a grandmother and not wanting to leave the kind of legacy that we're heading toward, I felt I had to act. And I actually heard one of the native leaders speak to a reporter and tell him that we can live for a long time without food, but clean water is essential to all life. And felt like, well, I could go for a long time without food if it made the point.
Keep up with Donna Dillman's struggle at www.ccamu.ca. Across the country, Canadians are fighting to keep radioactive materials below the ground where they belong. At the heart of it, right in Saskatchewan, is activist Jim Harding. We have him on the phone now. Today we're going to investigate Canada's deadly secret with author Jim Harding. The subtitle is Saskatchewan Uranium and the Global Nuclear System. The book is published by Fernwood, and the foreword is by the famous anti-nuclear activist Dr. Helen Caldicott. Jim, for those outside Canada, can you tell us where Saskatchewan is and why a relatively quiet part of Canada should matter so much to the rest of the world?
Well, Saskatchewan's in the prairies with Manitoba to our east, Alberta, the big oil province to our west. And we are known for grain in the southern prairies, but the truth is the mineral non-renewable industry in the north is actually what's driving the Saskatchewan economy. And it's the location of some of the earliest uranium mines in the 1950s that provided fuel for the nuclear weapons of the United States. Even that history back that far isn't widely known yet.
Well, how did Canada set out to become part of the nuclear weapons game?
Well, we were involved in the Manhattan Project almost from the beginning. Port Radium in the Northwest Territories, which initially was mined for radium, was reopened to mine for uranium that now is known to have provided the fuel for the weapon dropped on Hiroshima. So there was a direct connection into the Manhattan Project that produced the first A-bomb in terms of uranium. But the Chalk River plant, actually the precursor to the CANDU reactor, it actually produced weapons-grade plutonium for the Manhattan Project and later for the sort of growth of the nuclear arsenal. So we've been in there on both ends, the uranium fuel end and the reactor technology end. And of course the CANDU went on to be I from my perspective, infamous because the technology that went to India and then to Pakistan is the basis of both those countries becoming nuclear armed. And of course, we're in a that is one of the dangerous places on the planet, along with the Middle East.
Well, Canada even trained one of the world's worst nuclear terrorists from some people's perspective, Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan, the father of the bomb in Pakistan, they call him. Mm-hmm. He was trained at the Bruce nuclear plant in Ontario, mm-hmm. and then covertly leaked secret nuclear plans to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. So it seems like once you start this game,
yep.
Even though you're talking about peaceful nuclear power, in fact, it heads out and becomes weapons again.
You know... What we have to learn very quickly, because of course the nuclear industry is again promoting itself around the climate change issue, and I'm having to address that question with a lot of people. But what we have to learn is there never was a distinction between the weapons and the commercial side of the industry. And I keep saying that to people over and over because I have had to say it to myself. When I wrote this book, I found as I got further and further into the history and connecting dots that I hadn't really taken the time to connect, possibly because it's pretty frightening stuff to work with, I realized that I'd been a bit suckered myself into buying into this separation. There is no separation. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is supposed to guarantee nuclear technology only for peaceful purposes, doesn't actually prevent the uranium and the nuclear fuel cycle from going from the commercial to the weapons. And we've tracked that down, and I discuss it in the book. But in the case of Saskatchewan, we know all the uranium in the 50s and the 60s went directly into weapons. Then the Non-Proliferation Treaties declared in 1970, and from then on, all the government said, oh no, oh no, it's only going for, quote, peaceful purposes. Well, of course, a nuclear reactor is not peaceful in the health or environmental sense anyway, because studies do show increased deaths from leukemia from children 9 and under adjacent to nuclear facilities. Those are international studies now. But from the point of view of weapons, you can take the uranium from Saskatchewan, go into enriching facilities in Kentucky in the States, which, by the way, are coal-fired, increasing greenhouse gases. And then all the depleted uranium left after the enriching, which is about 90% of the mass, is available to the military, and that's not controlled by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we now know that DU goes into military reactors. They create weapons-grade plutonium. The DU is the casings for H-bombs, and the DU, of course, is going into the bullets and the uranium weapons that are actually being used and have been used in the last 5 wars. So we just have to start saying this as loudly and clearly as we can, because we are, in Saskatchewan and Canada, directly involved in these low-level, what I think really is a low-level nuclear war in certainly Kosovo, Bosnia.
Well, sure. We've spread all kinds of nuclear materials in Iraq through these mm-hmm. Nuclear tank shells, the depleted yep. uranium stuff. Well, how much of the world's uranium does Saskatchewan provide?
Well, we're at the top. If Cigar Lake, the biggest mine and highest grade uranium in the world, comes on stream at all, they've just flooded again, and maybe Mother Nature's not going to keep the uranium in the ground. But if it comes on stream, Canada could be pushing up to 35 or even more percent of the world production. We're at certainly a third now. And Australia would be about 20%. So just Canada and Australia themselves are well over half. And, of course, that's one reason I wanted to link this analysis of Saskatchewan into Helen Caldicott and the Australian people, because they're earmarked to become the next big front end if the industry gets its way and expands nuclear through, you know, this period of time. But
two countries, you know, people who think they're very nice, and they are yep. nice people when you meet them,
yep.
Still allowing this nuclear club to keep pushing this dangerous material out into the world. How does that happen?
Well, you know, I'm hoping the change of government in Australia, and we can hope for one here, will be just a little move in the right direction. Howard, who was defeated, was very much in the same camp as Harper and Bush. And some of their plans, which have surfaced since this book was published, but I've continued writing on it, this global nuclear energy plan of Bush's had Howard and certainly Harper on side. And what it looked like they were moving to, because Saskatchewan and Australia were the big uranium suppliers, was to maintain a monopoly on the nuclear weapons technology in the existing nuclear powers by taking waste back to Australia and Canada and building enriching and reprocessing facilities in those countries so that they would be then enabling uranium to go in to expand nuclear power commercially but maintain the weapons grade material for the U.S., etc.
So we could be a nuclear colony then.
And if we were to fulfill that scenario, yes. And, of course, we would be battling the nuclear waste issue in northern Saskatchewan.
So they want to bring waste back to beautiful northern Saskatchewan and dump it there?
Well, the proposal to build a new generation of CANDUs in northern Alberta, it's a piece of proposal at Peace River, and secondarily at Whitecourt. When we looked at the design plans that the AACL was promoting, those reactors would be designed to, in fact, take back spent fuel, including from the light water design of the U.S. and the French system. So since Areva, which is the biggest nuclear corporation on the planet, the French company, is also active in northern Saskatchewan, and building up nuclear waste all over France at the sites of their 60 or so reactors, yes, we're being a bit suspicious that it looks like we could be one of the northern Canada in the prairies, could be one of the international sites that gets targeted, and all in the name of replacing a little bit of natural gas in the oil fields and supposedly that contributing to reducing the risks of climate change. I mean, the pretenses of these things we've learned are usually public relations to try and get politicians and the public opinion on side in terms of some kind of economic spin-off. But behind the scenes, the more research we do, we do find that the nuclear weapons connection is usually there.
Well, I've been seeing some ads that say that nuclear power is the answer to climate change, and, you know, it doesn't emit so much carbon. Doesn't it work out as far as carbon dioxide goes just to build some nuclear plants?
Well, even Jeffrey Simpson said that in his Globe column yesterday, which surprised me, but he's sort of paraphrasing one of the members of the UN Intergovernmental Joint Panel, which has been raising awareness about the risks of climate change. It is true if you compare a coal plant to a nuclear power plant and don't look at the nuclear fuel cycle, that you'll get far less greenhouse gases. But if you add the whole nuclear fuel cycle in, it's certainly very debatable. There are some people who actually say if nuclear power was expanded to replace coal, that with the shortage of high-grade uranium, which is a non-renewable, we'd be back into such energy-intensive mining to get sufficient fuel that we'd almost be back to the same levels of greenhouse gases because the mining end and certainly the enriching end are extremely energy intensive. And of course, let's not forget what kind of fossil fuels go into building the cement and the steel for the nuclear power plant. So it is I don't want to say it's a silly position because it is having some effectiveness in terms of public relations. But it's a thoughtless position. They clearly aren't looking at this thing systematically. The other side of it is, of course, if you were expanding nuclear to make a small dent in greenhouse gases, you would be increasing the chances of proliferation, which we've just talked about. So those risks certainly should be pushing us towards the renewables. And the economics of nuclear is just horrendous. The hidden subsidies.
Oh, it never pays for itself. It's just, billions and billions of dollars keep going down the tube while they tell us how cheap it is, and the government has to insure it or it wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say the conclusion I've come to after looking at this is the only reason why these different nuclear states would put so much public backing into this technology to make it appear to be competitive, because it's probably about a third of its real cost when you look at the insurance subsidies and the outright subsidies. Like AECL just got another $500 million from Harper for cleanup. It has nothing to do with any new source of electricity. Simply cleanup, because Chalk River is contaminated and White Shell in Manitoba. And we're starting, of course, to see just the extent to which the contamination of the nuclear technology has affected us.
Well, Jim,
Hope is contaminated. Cameco has been shut down. That's the uranium refinery. I've just read the study from Albany where they did use depleted uranium for production of weapons grade material, and they've gone back and they found the civilians living there any period of 10 years in the last 23 since that plant was shut down have extremely high levels of rare cancers. So we're starting, slowly we're starting to actually go back and look at the impacts in terms of nuclear waste. And I don't just mean nuclear reactor waste. I mean waste at every point along the cycle. And those costs are basically invisible when nuclear electricity is costed. But the governments, of course, are willing to back electricity and make it appear to be cheap because of the weapons connection. That's the only thing that makes it make sense.
Well, as we speak, grandmother in Ontario is in about day 45 of her hunger strike. I'm worried about her, Donna Dillman, in order to prevent uranium prospecting in eastern Ontario.
Right.
We have another group here in British Columbia in the Kettle River Valley trying to fight off more uranium prospecting or a uranium mine. Can you tell us about the ecological impact of uranium mining in Saskatchewan and maybe a little bit about the miners themselves?
Yeah, and let's remember the reason why these new sites are being targeted is because with the price of uranium skyrocketing, just like oil, as non-renewables, it's, of course, now becoming profitable to go after the lower-grade ores because Cameco, in northern Saskatchewan is mining, and Kojima, the French company, very high-grade ores. But now lots of other investors want to get in on it because there's a short-term buck to be made. But the long-term legacy is what we ought to be looking at in terms of sustainability issues. And the nuclear, the tailings waste is where the bulk of the radioactivity remains. Those become available to the biosphere in ways that they aren't when they're left in the ground as hard rock. Of course, uranium is a natural element. But it doesn't spread into the aquatic systems and the airborne sort of pollution that occurs with the tailings. There's been major, major spills at the uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan, things that in the public inquiries in the 70s that approved these mines were said to be impossible, of course, were possible. Key Lake spill, 84, Wollaston Lake, huge spill, 89, and now the Cigar Lake underground mine has flooded. So even the drilling into the high-level uranium rock creates vents for radon gas to come out. And one of the hearings in 93 in Saskatchewan actually recommended against the mine going ahead, which the government of the day did not listen to, because of such things as 600 holes drilled deeply into high-grade uranium ore, which were venting alpha radiation, which if you breathe much of that, your risks of lung cancer go up. So basically, uranium mining makes the radioactivity in the geology where the uranium is available to the biosphere. And I always say, here we are, we're being pretty stupid because we produce chemicals that create holes in the ozone which increase the ultraviolet radiation on human and plant life. And then we bore holes into the radioactivity in the earth which make that radioactivity available to animal and plant life. All when we could be just moving with renewable, non-polluting technology. But of course, these non-renewable industries have, for reasons of weapons and for reasons of the power of the oil industry, have been running the show for a long, long time. So there's a mindset that we have to change, a fundamental change in mindset, which of course is why this battle over nuclear is so important. Because, you know, we don't want to get distracted with this notion that nuclear is somehow the answer to global warming, because we're going to get locked more into this high-cost technology, the radioactive waste, and we're not doing what the Brundtland Commission on Sustainable Development was arguing, because we're going to make things rougher for future generations, not just with climate change. But
well, for thousands of years, they're going to have to look after our mess just so we can power our Game Boys here. This isn't.
And they won't be getting electricity. I keep pointing out to people, we're getting very short-term benefits and they're getting very long-term burdens. And from a justice perspective, it's just simply wrong. And it's taking a while to get that message through.
How can people find out more about Canada's nuclear game and the groups who oppose it?
Well, there's networks forming very quickly again. I'm quite amazed. You know, all the environmental groups, provincially, the Saskatchewan Environmental Network or the Saskatchewan Environmental Society or the Sierra groups, they're all moving alternative energy information now quite quickly. And that Ontario network, I think, has built connections all across the country where the woman is protesting.
Donna Dillman,
yeah.
Yes.
And I'm sending them material regularly, and I'm going to go down and do some workshops down there after Christmas. The beyondnuclear.org site in the States, doing really good work. World Information Services on Energy, WISE, has sites and does very good work out of Amsterdam. You know, if you just actually Google non-nuclear or anti-nuclear now, you'd be just amazed. I mean, my stuff's moving probably faster. The information that I've done sort of based to build up this book is probably moving more through internet articles and commentaries than it is through bookstores, which, you know, is clearly a good idea. I mean, books matter, but boy, it seems sure an awful lot more information seems to be moving on the internet.
Although I really enjoyed the book, I think that it's helped me draw together a lot of things that were sort of put all over the net, but there it is tight in one book, and it's really your lifetime's work that's coming out here. It's called Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan and the Global Nuclear System by Fernwood Books. How can people find that book, Jim?
It should be in most of the independent bookstores now. I know in Victoria, Munro's carrying it. I'm not sure in Vancouver yet who is, but it actually, when it was released in late October, one of the guys at Fernwood was monitoring the sort of the Google site on new books, and it was in the top 10 and then the top 20 for several days. So clearly it's out there somewhere. I know in Saskatchewan, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if 400 or 500 have sold already, which is actually very good for that market.
Well, that's good news. Jim Harding, thank you for sharing a little radiation with Radio EcoShock. And this is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for calling.
That was Jim Harding, one of a growing chorus of voices against uranium mining in Canada. You have been listening to the All Environment Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith. Tune into our website at www.ecoshock.org for tons of free materials. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Thanks for caring. Here is another clip from songwriter Celia. Find her at myspace.com/Celia online.
Don't worry. The government's got global warming covered. We're entitled to destroy, consume, and clean. Hello, there has got to be a better way. And oh, hold on tight to ease the pain. Then lovingly let it go. Lovingly let it go. Release your grip, nice and slow. TV, IV drip, go make some babies. We'll need some superhuman kids so we can pass it off. Well, there are lots of kinder ways to mother. This world's already hungry children. Hello. 200 species a day. And oh, we are getting sick from holding on to all this rage and shame. Community writes the show.